Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I am your host, Jeff Boundren. With me, in fact, is my co-host, a man who I will describe to you as a hit maker, the record breaker. He's got style, he's got grace, he's got a pretty face. He'll make your back crack, and he will make your liver quiver. Barry Rose, how you doing?
Oh, man, I'm doing fantastic. It's exciting, man. We haven't recorded because summer is here, and it's been a great summer for me so far. And Jeff, I don't know how you're not as much of a beach guy or a pool guy as I am, but when I see sunlight, I don't care if it's 7 a.m. I want to run out to the beach, go swimming. I want to do something. So it's been a great summer. But with that being said, I don't feel like we haven't recorded an episode in, what, 3 weeks? This is our first time in 3 weeks. We did 3 episodes in 1 week, but right before the vacation, something crazy like that, or 2 in 1 night. But I'm real excited to be back, and we are going to be talking today a subject that honestly, I don't know why it's taken us. Jeff, what are we at? 46 episodes, right?
45.
Now? 45. It's taken us 45, which is really about a little over 10 months, if my math is correct, that it's taken us this long to discuss this topic. So I'm real excited about this.
All righty. So on this show, we're not going to just discuss pro wrestling. We're going to discuss stuff like movies, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. We are the brothership. That is what I hear, Barry. So strap yourself in. It may be a bumpy ride. So Barry, couple things before we get to, oh, by the way, let me just tell you, we're going to discuss one match that should have been on my top 100 after watching it, Barry. It is a flat out throwdown that we somehow have managed to miss. And that is Terry Funk versus Jerry Lawler in 1981. No, I'm not talking the empty arena match. I'm talking about the one, I believe it happened the week before that. And we are also going to be taking a look, Barry. I know that you are a huge, huge fan of director John Hughes. We are coming up on the anniversary of his death. So we're not doing a top five this week, but we are going to do a deep dive on John Hughes films because that is a subject near and dear to Barry's heart. Before we get to the John Hughes and the Terry Funk stuff, Barry, we had a really, really bad day a couple weeks back where we lost Brickhouse Brown, we lost Brian Lawler, and we lost a guy that's near and dear to the good folks here in Florida's heart, and that's Nikolai Volkoff. Why don't you regale us with some memories of Nikolai Volkoff's time spent in the great state of Florida?
Yeah, I was really bummed too. So Nikolai was one of the nicer guys you would ever meet, a very gentle giant. And he did a lot of fan fest appearances. If it was in the Northeast, he was going to be there. And I saw him at Comic Cons. I saw him at Wrestling Fan Fest. He was at Horror Cons. He was everywhere. And it kind of became a running joke that I wonder what area Nikolai's going to be in. And sadly, I never took advantage of spending time with Nikolai because he always seemed really engaging. And I guess I was always wrapped up in, you know, meeting like the people from RoboCop or Nightmare on Elm Street or something like that. So I really regret that. But Nikolai was a guy that came into Florida. He was a big guy, a big barrel-chested, a real physical specimen. I'm going to say 6'4", maybe 6'3", but really taller than most of the other wrestlers we saw, and physically looked to be about 300 pounds. So a really imposing figure, but supposedly behind the scenes, he was like this big teddy bear that just was loved by everybody. I will tell you a story that Paul Jones shared with me, and I wasn't sure when I heard this story if it was legit, but then I heard it from several people afterwards that it was legit. And it was a story that involved Manny Fernandez, and Paul and Manny really never got along. They were, even though Paul was the manager for Manny and Rick Rude when they were World Tag Team Champions for Crockett, which I believe was 85, 86, somewhere in there, they never got along. Manny didn't like Paul, and Paul didn't like Manny. But there was an instance apparently that occurred in, and I want to say it was Jacksonville, and Manny was the baby face, Nikolai was the heel, and according to Paul, that Manny was bullying Nikolai, and Nikolai was very soft spoken apparently, and he was bullying him, and Nikolai just basically just knocked him out in the dressing room. And Paul, who never liked Manny, really got a kick out of that story and was telling me all about it. But it, you know, Nikolai was great. He was put in, you know, in the Russian tag team thing. He teamed with Ivan Koloff. You know, Lord Alfred Hayes was here as their manager. Sir Oliver Humperdinck also at one point. So just, you know, a really imposing figure, but supposedly behind the scenes, the nicest guy you would ever hope to meet. Everybody loved him, you know, a kind word for him. And he really had a hell of a career too. You know, when you go back and you look and you consider he started off, pardon me, as one of the Mongols, you know, and then just kind of transformed from there and was in the AWA as Boris Brezhnikov and then, you know, worked under Nikolai Volkov and really had a run, you know, from Nikolai. You know, that was something like 12 years just as Nikolai Volkov, you know, in the WWE and then the other territories. So a really, really strong performer and real sad. You know, he died, I believe he was 70, which, you know, in this day and age, it's kind of he's kind of young. Brian Christopher, that's a real tragedy right there. You and I discussed this off air at length. And, I kind of feel that Brian, right from the get-go, just it was kind of tough for him. I think growing up as the son of, you know, one of the biggest celebrities in Memphis, Tennessee, I just think Brian, you know, it was really, really tough. And Brickhouse Brown, only in professional wrestling does somebody die and then come back to life and then die again a week later. So, you know, but just, again, another guy that apparently when he was out in the Cauliflower Alley Club just made such an impression on people. And those guys at CAC do really, really good work in distributing funds. And Brian Blair, who's a good friend of both of ours, you know, is just really taken this organization and been able to get funds and give it to people in need, and Brickhouse being one of those. So, yeah, it's tough. It's, you know, as we get older, Jeff, and, you know, as our listeners get older, our idols get older. And it's, you know, the people that we watched up. And Brian Christopher, he was young. You know, I think he was 48 years old. But, you know, guys like Nikolai Volkov that, you know, they hit get in their 70s and they start to pass away. You know, we see this. But, yeah, very sad.
So a couple of points. Number one, Nikolai Volkov. If you look at pictures of Nikolai Volkov, like mid-70s even, he was absolutely a physical freak. There just weren't guys. He was bigger than Billy Graham. I mean, body mass wise, he wasn't as cut as Billy Graham, but he was still pretty amazingly cut for that time period. And one of the things that I always loved about Nikolai, was during his run in Florida, they did the gimmick. And, you know, I really don't know if this is the first time this gimmick was used where they put the headgear on Nikolai's head to allegedly prevent the fans from yelling USA, USA at him. And he would just start screeching on his interviews how much he hated the fans doing that, which, of course, you know, they made him scream more. And I know they did the same deal in Smoky Mountain. I think it was when Stan Lane was getting new kind of hairpiece. But so they came up with this gimmick where Stan was wearing headgear, and it was because he didn't want the fans booing at him. But that's just a gimmick that I've always loved in pro wrestling, and I really wonder whether or not Nikolai might have been the first guy to do that. Brian Lawler, I will give a special shout out to our friend Trav Scott Bowden, his Kentucky Fried Wrestling podcast, where he discussed his memories. He met Brian when he was 16, 17 years old. Some very, very touching memories. If you are a Brian Lawler fan, I mean, you have not, or Brian Christopher fan, have not heard that show, I encourage you to seek it out because it's some very touching stuff. As Trav Scott Bowden offers some memories of the fact that, you know, here Brian was trying so hard not only to live up to his father's legacy, but to basically try to have a relationship with his father. And really, that's just so sad. Brickhouse Brown, again, that you're absolutely right. The story about him kicking out from death's door and hanging out for another week. And the quote that I was just listening to the Jim Cornette show today on the way home from work, and he said, the mother was in there and she heard Brickhouse say, "Mama, I'm hungry." And she got another week out of him. So God bless him. You know, he had a run as part of the Breakdancers in Florida. Am I wrong?
You did. You're 100% right with Mark Reagan. They were who I think was a guy that they worked Memphis also. I don't know if they worked together, but I know Mark Reagan was a guy that was looked like he was going to get a push in Memphis and it didn't really happen. But they were part of the Breakdancers tag team in 84.
Yeah, that wasn't a especially long run, as I recall. But anyway, our memories and thoughts are with the families of those that have departed, and we'll miss all those guys. We raise a frosty beverage in their memory. So now, next, let's go on to slightly funner topics. Of course, Barry, here's something that came across. I read it somewhere, so I'm going to throw this at you. Barry, you're a fan of peanut butter, are you?
Oh, absolutely.
So tell me your favorite go-to peanut butter brand.
It's going to be Skippy Chunky, I think. And I like, so again, you and I talked about this, but you know, there's a big debate out there apparently, and it's kind of like ketchup on hot dogs and pineapple on pizza. When you eat peanut butter, is it chunky or is it creamy?
I strictly go for the chunky, and I strictly am a Peter Pan man. I stock up and usually have an extra jar in the cupboard because my wife knows if I don't have peanut butter in the house, I begin to slowly freak out. So you're not a fan of Jif, are you?
No, I like Jif. I mean, the truth is, if you're, as long as you're not bringing me that the healthy fucking shit peanut butter that my
Nutella.
Wife brings in the house for the kids. No, Nutella isn't healthy at all. Nutella is the worst for you. It's like fucking hazelnut and chocolate. But there's all these healthy brands that you can buy at places like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's, and the oil separates, and you've got to, I don't want that shit. I want my chunky with preservatives in it. I want the real stuff. I like Peter Pan. A lot, Jif, Skippy, all the big names I like, but it's got to be chunky. That creamy stuff, I can't take that.
So here's something that I really like. I get my toast, put it in the toaster, get it dark because I like the dark toast, as we discussed before. Then you take that peanut butter, you put it on the bread, you let it melt just a little bit. Boom!
Absolutely.
That is a go-to thing. Okay, another thing that came up.
Jeff, what? I have to hold up here. If we're talking about food, and we are, because we're discussing peanut butter and peanut butter brands, I have to bring up something that occurred over the last week and a half, which is something I'm calling personally Salad Gate 2018. What? Apparently, there is a big rumor going around town that I'm hearing that Jeff Bowdrin was eating some salad somewhere in a suburb of Jacksonville. Is this true or not?
Scuttlebutt, innuendo, if you will, Mr. Rose, throwing me under the bus. Now let me wait for you to back over me. What had happened? Dad's 90th birthday, in conjunction with the wife and I celebrating the wedded bliss, the anniversary of that, and my wife's birthday. So shout out to my lovely wife, Kim, for her birthday. And I'll tell you about a rare marital misstep in just a second. But so the wife, we went to a lovely evening out at Ruth's Chris, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And so we're getting ready for the big steak entree when the salad comes out. And so I'm joking with my wife. And I said, you know, I'm not completely opposed to salad. I'm just not one that'll get the tomatoes and the onions and all that kind of stuff. And so my wife goes, really? Really? Well, why don't you have a piece of lettuce? Why don't you have a piece of lettuce? And I said, okay. She gives me the fork. I take a piece of lettuce. It's got a little bit of salad dressing on it. And I managed to survive the evening. One piece of lettuce. I consider that salad, Barry.
That's Salad Gate 2018, absolutely. So I love salad, and granted, I'll eat as much shit as the next guy, whether it's pizza, McDonald's, it doesn't matter. But at the same time, I really love salad, and you said it to me. You said something about, well, the dressing. And I'm like, yeah, of course the dressing. The dressing is the best part of any salad. But I do like the texture of salad. I like the crunchiness. I don't like a soggy salad. That's something. So if you're going to give me, like, the, you know, years ago the trend was, and it's still a little bit trendy, like these mesclun greens, these field greens, which are very kind of soft. They're not, there's no real texture or crunch to it. And some people love that. I don't. Give me iceberg. Give me romaine. Give me something that's going to be crunchy. So you just said tomatoes and onions. You're not a fan of tomatoes and onions?
No. I try as hard as possible to stay away from anything that might be remotely healthy for me. And anyone who's known me for a long time can tell you that. So let me tell you about the rare marital misstep. I'm going to tell the good folks listening to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm going to break kayfabe on the Bowdrin marriage here, Barry. So let me tell you what happened to me over the weekend. So, as I said, we're out there. We're celebrating Dad's birthday. My wife and I, our anniversary. It's my wife's birthday. Kind of a triple header of celebration there at the old Roost Chris. So then the next day we get up, we drive back. It's Sunday morning. We drive back to Casa de Baldron here in Western Fort Lauderdale. And so we get back. So it's Jacksonville is probably about a 4.5 hour drive. We, of course, make it in 3 hours, 45 minutes because Mr. and Mrs. Baldron may have been speeding a little bit. But we get back. So, of course, when you get back from a trip, you're unpacking your bags. You know, wife starts the laundry. We're doing a little cleaning. And then the wife says, hey, so what do you want to do for dinner? And I said, well, you know, quite frankly, because it was my father's birthday and the anniversary and stuff like that, we picked up the tab at Roost Chris, okay? So I said, well, yeah, last night, I got to be honest with you, a little bit expensive. Why don't we just stay in tonight? Why don't you just make something easy? Okay. So then we went to the grocery store for the weekend grocery shopping, and I noticed in the store, Barry, tell me if this is something that happens with you and Mrs. Rose. I started getting what I call the yeps and the nopes. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That actually, that transcends into life, not just the grocery store. So, yes, I am familiar.
So I'm getting the yeps and the nopes from Mrs. Baldron. We finish the grocery shop and we get back. And so I said, did I do anything wrong? No. I said, okay, are you sure you're not mad? No, not at all. And a couple more minutes of relatively quiet time here in the Baldron house. I go in, and you know, I'm thinking it's her birthday. Maybe she's missing our children. So I go in. I said, okay, let me just ask you. I said, are you mad at me, or is this one of these? It's my birthday, and the kids aren't here, and I miss them and want to be with them. Which one are we talking about? And then I hear the statement that every man in a marriage situation fears, Barry. Do you know what that statement is?
No more blowjobs.
No, unfortunately not that.
Oh, sorry.
The statement is, do you really want to know what I'm upset about? And, you know, that is when, as the quote, the great Led Zeppelin, that's when the levee broke.
Wow.
And that's when Mrs. Baldron informed me that it was her birthday and she did not feel like cooking dinner. So I said, honey, I love you. Where do you want to go for dinner? So Mrs. Baldron got her choice of dinner that night, Barry.
Where did you go?
I shouldn't tell you because you hate it. You hate the place. We went authentic Italian at the Olive Garden.
Oh,
that's where she wanted
Mrs.
to go.
Mrs. Baldron, celebrating her 29th birthday, chose the Olive Garden.
Oh, you know, I said, honey, you pick the place. I don't care. It's your birthday. I want you to be happy.
Okay.
I want to go to Olive Garden. I said, okay, well, that's where we'll go. Now, speaking of Mrs. Baldron, Mrs. Baldron was actually involved on a recent thread on our Facebook group, Breaking Kayfabe with Baldron and Barry, which, by the way, Barry, our Facebook group, like 825 people on the Facebook group now, doing some stellar work over there. But a thread was posted. We discussed our favorite Stephen King movies, Barry. Tell me if you have a favorite Stephen King book.
Yeah, you know what? I guess I do, but I don't. I don't think I've read that many of Stephen King's novels. Christine, I'm going to assume I actually saw the movie first, and then I went and read the book because I liked the movie that much. So I guess I would say Christine. But the truth is, I think I've only read 4 or 5 at max. And it's been years since I read them, so I'll say Christine, but it's probably not the best educated answer right there.
Okay, I'm going to go Dead Zone. I thought that was a really good book. My wife posted that her favorite, I believe, was Under the Dome. She was a big fan of that, which turned into a TV show on CBS.
Did you ever see that show?
I actually watched the first year, and I thought the first year was really compelling, and then I think it kind of fell off the cliff for me.
Oh, it absolutely. So it was the weirdest thing, and there was a good friend of mine that we used to discuss it every week. It was kind of like a Seinfeld thing for us. We would get together the day after the show. I think it was Thursdays, I forget, and then Friday morning we would discuss the show. Actually, I think it was Mondays, but the first year was great, and it was especially the first few episodes to me were like, this is groundbreaking. This is on regular TV. This is fantastic, and slowly it started to progress or digress. It was definitely going downhill. By the end of the second year, it was like, boy, this really sucks. Because at that point, they could actually get out of the dome and then get back into the dome. And I'm like, what the fuck? You're out of the dome. That was the whole purpose of the show.
What was the name of the actor that played the lead? He was in Breaking Bad. He played like the brother-in-law in Breaking Bad.
Oh, he was great. Dean Norris is
that's his name.
And he played the bad guy. It was like Big Something. big.
He was like the town bully, town boss kind of thing. Yeah. But he's a really good character actor.
Oh, he's great. He's great. He was kind of, he was a real heel, and then he did a baby face flip. He did a baby face turn towards the end. But yeah, it was such a good show, and it had so much promise. And in the beginning, I was like, this is great. And then literally halfway through the second season, I was like, what a load of shit this is. That was a real, real disappointment.
Yeah. So, Barry, I real quick want to just make a mention. On our last episode that we recorded, I made a mention of the fact that my son Andy has Asperger syndrome, which is a, for those of you that don't know, it's a very mild form of autism. It is what they consider someone who has Asperger's to be, quote, a high-functioning autistic, meaning that they, you know, my son, he goes, he has a job, he works as a, works in a pharmacy, but he has social social inabilities. He's not a guy that'll go and be the life of the party. They're usually very introverted. They usually focus on one thing. And the reason I bring this up, Barry, is I was very happily and pleasantly surprised to see a number of people reach out to me via private messenger. I had one gentleman reach out and told me that he has Asperger's, and we were discussing this affliction. You know, and it's really weird because I never know. It's not a disease, you know. It's a condition. And, you know, this person was discussing how he deals with his life every day. And then I had some other people on the Facebook group that told me that they knew somebody that had Asperger's. And, you know, the doctor, when my son was originally diagnosed, said that Asperger's, because it was so undiagnosed until, you know, recently, you think about when you were in high school, Barry, and I knew people like this, that it was the kid that was just a nice kid, but a little bit different. That's the way the doctor described it to me. And I sit back and I think back when I was in high school or in college, and I'm like, yeah, I think I kind of knew a kid like that. And, you know, it makes me wonder in retrospect whether or not this undiagnosed condition could have explained a lot of things. And I wanted to say that I really appreciate the people that did reach out to me, took some time to discuss Asperger's and what it's like dealing with that, not only as a parent, but someone. And, you know, the funny thing is, my wife always says, my son doesn't bother him the least that he has it, because he lives his life. He's a happy kid. He works hard. And so anyway, I just wanted to give that little shout out of appreciation. Now, talk about going from the yin to the yang. Barry, do you know what time it is, my friend?
I'm going to assume I am going to get ready to F, marry, or kill someone.
It is time for America's favorite game, F, marry, or kill. Drink of water for the working man. Barry, I know that you've told us here on Breaking Kayfabe that your absolute favorite movie actor, without question, is Tom Cruise. So, since Tom recently had a new movie release, which I'm sure you're not going to go see, and I haven't had a chance to see yet.
I am going to go see it because I've heard that fucking Mission Impossible movie is out of this world. As much as I don't like Tom Cruise, I'm going to go see this movie.
Well, I'm going to offer you a Tom Cruise-related F-Marry. No, I'm not going to ask you if you're going to F-Marry or kill Tom, but, you know, Tom has quite the legacy with the ladies. So, Barry, F, marry, or kill Rebecca De Mornay, Nicole Kidman, Katie Holmes. Who you got?
Katie Holmes, Rebecca De Mornay, and what was the other one?
Nicole Kidman.
Nicole Kidman. I'm going to kill Nicole Kidman, and I'm going to kill her based off of the plastic surgery that she's had. If we're talking Nicole Kidman 20, 25 years ago, it might be different, but I'm going to go with current. So I am going to kill Nicole Kidman. I am going to F Katie Holmes, but I'm going to marry Rebecca De Mornay. And even though it's been probably 35 years since Risky Business came out, wasn't there a heterosexual teen or young adult male that didn't want to get with her? And Risk, what a great movie. That to me, you know, he made two movies, Tom Cruise. One was called Risky Business, obviously. The other one was All the Right Moves. And he was such a likable guy. And then he just somehow went down, quote unquote, Jeff, the rabbit hole. And he went down this hole that just, I don't know, became completely unlikable to me. But I loved Risky Business. What a great movie. Vito the Killer Pimp, our boy Joey Pants. So yeah, Rebecca De Mornay, you know, she's one too. She made a couple of movies afterwards and still appears in stuff, but really after that movie, she never really broke out as a star. And I feel that she had it all. You know who her father was, right?
I was just going to drop that on you. Yes. Wally George.
Yeah, so. I think that was part of the reason I think she claimed, because they had a huge falling out prior to her success in any form. I don't think they ever reconciled before his death. She completely did not want to be associated with him. And Wally George, for our younger listeners that aren't, you know, as old as Jeff and I, he was kind of, and then I'll date myself again, he was kind of a Morton Downey Jr., which, you know, who would be comparable now? I would say Alex Jones, but I don't think you could really compare him to Alex Jones. But he was this right-wing, and maybe you can, he was this right-wing kind of nut that had this cable access show out in Southern California and got some notoriety nationwide. I don't know if it was syndicated, but he was just, you know, he was just way over the top with what he was doing. I don't know if he believed it. It seemed like it was contrived because he was so over the top. But, you know, there was a period there in the 80s where Wally George, people were talking about him. So it's hard to believe that something as perfect and as lovely as Rebecca De Mornay could have come from the loins of a guy like Wally George.
Yeah, I think she also made a film that was very well, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, I want to say.
Yes.
That she was very, very good in. So, okay, so that's a great selection there, Barry. Now I'm going to tell you that it's time to discuss a match. And I'm going to give a little shout out to my friend Gary Baum at work. I've talked about Gary before. Gary comes up to me today at work and where he said, you know, I listened to last week's episode. He said, you know what I love best about Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry? I love when you talk about guys like Terry Funk. Well, Gary Baum, this one's for you because we're going back to 1981. We're talking the King, Jerry Lawler versus Terry Funk. Barry, you had a chance to watch this match. Tell me what you thought about this match.
Yeah, so it's a no DQ match between Lawler and Funk. Terry Funk with manager Jimmy Hart prior to his WWF run. This is from spring of 81, and it's not the full match. It's only a portion. I think it's like almost 11 minutes. But, I mean, what are you going to say? This is Terry Funk in his prime right here, and this is Terry Funk doing all of his outrageous spots, his bumps. And Lawler in 81 was another guy, too, that just was – he was solid. And this was such a good feud, and they brought this feud down to Florida, if you remember.
Yes.
I think this is when Dory was booking, so Terry was always spending some time in Florida, and they brought Lawler down. So you had the feud that was really going between two territories, and these two guys were made to work together, in my opinion. They did all their spots. You know, Terry does all of his bumps. But, you know, in discussing this match, and it's a very, very good match. Again, we're not seeing the entire match, so it's hard for me to judge. But, it's really, really good. So where does Lawler rate or rank as far as Terry Funk's opponents? In my opinion, Terry Funk's greatest opponent will always be Dusty Rhodes. Just having seen them wrestle for a decade in every sort of gimmick and blood match, and Terry Funk costing Dusty the NWA World's Heavyweight Title after he chased that title for three and four years, and he finally wins it, and Terry costs him the title. To me, Terry and Dusty are the matchup there, but where does Terry Funk rate, or where does Jerry Lawler rate as far as an opponent for Terry Funk? I do think he's top five. What do you think, Jeff?
Just sitting here thinking, I would go to definitely Jack Briscoe. Thinking Harley Race. The first thing that popped into my head also was that for everyone that remembers Terry Funk and thinks about Terry Funk in the ECW. As good as he was in the ECW, you were really looking at basically the last remnants of Terry Funk, the Terry Funk from the early 80s in All Japan and in Florida and the stuff that's out there. I know that actually there's a match that's out there. I don't know how long this program went. There's a match somewhere on YouTube from Atlanta in the TV tapings with him against Bill Watts. And that's actually a really good TV match out there. So I'm going to go Jack Briscoe, Lawler, maybe Harley Race, but Lawler's definitely, I think, top five, no question about it. And I really think
too.
Yeah, I think the ECW stuff, you know, I'm sure people want to remember his stuff with, you know, Cactus Jack, and that was good stuff, but we're forgetting Brody and Hansen too, you know, because he worked some singles matches with those guys in All Japan too. So, but Lawler definitely would be in the top five.
Yeah, and you know, it's so interesting. You just mentioned the ECW stuff too. So here's Terry Funk, a guy that, you know, he started wrestling, what, 65, somewhere right around there, the mid-60s. And you know, and 20 years later, 30 years later, he's working ECW, and he's doing fucking moonsaults. Like, here's a 50-year-old man reinventing himself and doing a moonsault. That's insane. And that's, you know, the Terry Funk is insane, but we're so fortunate that we got to see him. So, good match. You know, you could see a young Jim Cornette is ringside. You see scattered all around ringside. He's shooting photographs. And this has to be within a year of him making his debut, even a little bit less, I think. That was kind of cool. Lawler does his Superman comeback. And that also got me to thinking, so who was the first guy to do a Superman comeback, a full one? We saw Dusty in Florida, and he did a version of it. But it wasn't, to say it's a Superman comeback, I don't know if that's really accurate. But when I see Lawler do it, I know exactly where I think Hulk Hogan got his Superman comeback from.
Well, and I'm sure guys like Bruno had to do that up in the Northeast too, because that was so much part of Bruno's appeal was him vanquishing, right, you know, the villain. So I got to tell you, I loved this match. And you're right, it's not the full complete match, but I think it's, because I think the match ends up going 14 minutes, and I think what we have on YouTube is somewhere in the neighborhood about 12 minutes. So we're not missing a lot. A couple things that I noted. I loved when they're doing the intros, and they're coming to the ring, and Lance Russell announces that Terry Funk is the guy from Paradise Alley. Oh, yeah, and he's the former NWA champion, too. Like, he kind of just throws out the end of it. But you know, let's remember that he was in Paradise Alley with Sylvester Stallone.
Right.
I love the fact that in the beginning of the match, Jerry Lawler goes chasing after Terry Funk. You know, we've talked about how these stipulation matches, there's nothing we hate more than them locking up collar and elbow when it's a no DQ match or a Texas death or some kind of stipulation match, and they lock up. I want to see guys who are pissed off at one another act like they're pissed off at one another, and that's exactly what happens there. They end up doing an atomic drop on the floor, and the reason I mention this is because the atomic drop at the time is sold like just this absolutely devastating move that happens to Lawler on the floor. And boy, talk about seemingly just a different time and space. The other thing that this match really reminded me of, you know, you see these things on Facebook and in different groups where people talk about who's on your Mount Rushmore of great wrestling managers. And pretty much everyone agrees that Cornette and Bobby Heenan belong on any sort of Mount Rushmore. But then, of course, there's, you know, there's the J.J. Dillons that are going to mention, the Gary Harts, you know, and Paul Dangerously people. But let me tell you people something. If you think that Jimmy Hart was the guy that was in the WWF, folks, you missed out on Jimmy Hart, because Jimmy Hart, as great as Lawler and Funk are in this match, Jimmy Hart might be the main event guy in this match, because he is absolutely electrifying to watch, just working the crowd, involving himself in the match. When he gets chased by Lawler, the way that he slips under the ring it's just absolutely amazing. And it reminded me a lot, dare I say, when you see the clips from Chicago with the way that Bobby Heenan ran around, and I think even he will have to agree, Jim Cornette did not ever move around the ring the way that Jimmy Hart and Bobby Heenan did. And when I saw Jimmy Hart moving around the ring in this match, I was reminded of a young Bobby Heenan, Barry.
Yeah, so you're 100% right. You know, most people remember Jimmy Hart from his WWF days, where, you know, and that really changed the game on everything, whether it's wrestling or managing. But Pete Lederberg, our old friend Pete, will tell you, during Jimmy Hart's heyday in Memphis, which would have been late 70s into the early 80s, he may have just been the best manager in the business at that point. And he was a natural magnet for getting heat. You know, I like that idea that who would be on your Rushmore for wrestling managers. And I'll tell you, a guy that I think is often overlooked is Sir Oliver Humperdinck. And I think part of the reason he's overlooked is that outside of Florida, you know, his national exposure was, you know, the horrible, ill-fated managerial time that he spent with Bam Bam Bigelow as a babyface, wearing that multi-shiny jacket. And then he was Big Daddy Dink in WCW, NWA, which also was terrible. But when we saw Humperdinck in the state of Florida, he was unbelievable. And, you know, he would turn red. He would just get so red. His eyes would bulge out. And when he talked, the spit would come out of his mouth. I just thought he was just a fantastic manager. And Jimmy, you know, I would say if you were looking at Florida, to me, it's Sir Oliver Humperdinck. I always thought Gary Hart was good. Yeah, but I don't know. I think Sir Oliver Humperdinck was much better. Jimmy Hart from Memphis, I would say. Bobby Heenan, I do like. Jim Cornette has to be on there. In that fifth slot, where who would I go with number five?
Well, there's only four people on Mount Rushmore, Barry.
There you go.
Obviously,
done.
You're a history
Thank
boss.
God. You know, so, no, not at all. Exactly.
Well, you know what I was going to ask you regarding Hump. Was Humperdinck the first guy in a angle to ever put his hands on Gordon Solie?
I believe so. I think it was Humperdinck and then Don Morocco, but I think Humperdinck was the first.
But that, I remember that was a real big deal when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, getting back to Jimmy Hart, he is absolutely electric in this match with the way that he moves around. Let me just see there. Lance Russell on the call says that Funk is bleeding from both eyes. Lance was really super here. And he points out that Lawler's white trunks, singlet or whatever he has, is covered with blood because both guys get color. They're going toe-to-toe. The crowd reaction is absolutely unbelievable in this match, Barry. And in particular, I'm going to, of course, post this this match on our Facebook group. Folks, if you get a chance to watch when they're going toe-to-toe and you look at the audience, there is a woman who's wearing a blue outfit. And I swear to God, Barry, she is throwing a punch with Jerry Lawler. Every time he throws a punch, and this woman's got to be like in her mid to late 60s. And she's throwing a punch with every punch Jerry Lawler throws. It's hilarious to watch. Jimmy Hart does a run in with a chair. The chair gets involved. Terry Funk goes after Lawler's leg with the chair. And then this was very interesting. He begins tearing away at Lawler's outfit and trying to get the knee pad. And he's like, he's actually biting the apparel so he can tear the apparel to get it. It's really, and Lance Russell is like, well, this is no DQ. He's allowed to do this. And then Funk puts Lawler in a spinning toe hold, except Lance calls it a spinning leg lock. But then Lawler gets the chair away. He begins to work on Funk's chair leg. He chases Funk down to the floor. Funk begins his patented crawl away from the ring, and Lawler keeps hitting him on the back of the leg, and Lawler jumps back in the ring, wins by countout. Absolutely, you know, it's funny. You know what I thought of, Barry? As I've been going back recently, and I've been doing some cataloging on our old episodes, and I happened to go back to, I don't know, it was in the early 20s somewhere. We were talking about the Bob Backlund, Ken Patera, Texas Death Match from Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
Folks, if you want to compare a New York version of a throwdown match and a Memphis version, watch the Patera Backlund, which is a really good match, and then watch Terry Funk and Jerry Lawler, because that is a throwdown right there. And that is what Memphis did probably better than anybody, was just sell the unbelievable hatred and vitriol the two guys had for one another. And Barry, I really like this match a lot.
Yeah, it's a good match too. So you mentioned the woman is. So I actually made a note too. It looks to me like she's wearing a white shirt, though it could be maybe a light color blue. But every time Lawler throws a punch, she throws a punch. And I stopped counting, but I think she throws six or seven punches. And she's directly dead center of the camera, so there's no way to miss her. So what I thought was interesting about this match, and it's a very, look, this match is, you're not going to get a bad match if Terry Funk and Lawler are working in 1981. It's a really, really good match. But was reading the comments on YouTube, did you happen to read the comments?
I actually did not.
So it's really interesting because there's a real divisiveness there between old school fans and new fans. And the new fans are like, when I say new fans, I mean people that basically grew up with the WWE and I guess still support the WWE and really haven't explored. But it's like, well, this match is kind of boring and all they do is punch and they kick. And in my head, I'm going, I could see where, you know, you might think that, but look at the crowd, and you referenced the crowd. The crowd is losing their mind. Everybody is screaming. Everybody is standing. Arms are flailing in the air. Everybody is so invested in. And somebody came on, and I forget what the guy's name was. I think it was I Am a Historian, which really, to me, is the worst possible name. Exactly. It's the worst possible name you could ever have.
But obviously a man of rare intelligence, we can tell.
Yeah, yeah. But he came on, and he started to break it down, and he said, well, this match was the payoff of a feud that had been going on for weeks. And even if the match isn't your version of what you think to be a 4 or 5 star match, or on the Chris Zaha scale, 8 trillion stars, whatever it is, this was what the fans wanted, and the fans dictated this match, and they're happy, because when you look at these fans, they could be no more ecstatic than they are. They're jumping up and down. So to me, it was really interesting to read the comments, because it's when one guy is saying, you know, man, this is a boring match, somebody else is saying, but if you were in that building, would you have thought the same way? And I don't think you would have. So, you know, it's obvious, Jeff, you and I are old school fans. We'll always be very defensive on what we saw, and maybe it's sometimes critical of what currently takes place. Though you and I both, you'll watch New Japan all the time. I watch it sometimes. We both watch NXT, the takeovers, and we both rave about those takeovers. I think those NXT takeover shows, which we have one coming up, I believe in about a week or so, they're just mind-blowingly fantastic. I so look forward to that. At the same time, I think a lot of the old school is, it's not something that you see automatically and go, this is the greatest thing ever. It was something, A, that you did have to experience and live, but there was more of a story to it. And there was, you know, if you look at this match and you don't understand the history of Lawler and Funk and the hatred and those interviews, which were just, again, the best interviews of all time, I don't know if it translates to the match. And I think that's kind of the difference. Does that make sense?
Oh, that's definitely a very fair point. You know, what I was thinking as you were talking about that, and you were talking about the NXT shows that are very well received and very well regarded. Barry, you know what else is very well received and well regarded? The Ring of Honor shows.
You know what? There's a Ring of Honor show coming up on August 25th. It's an international TV taping,
and
it's
taking place
in Philadelphia. Yeah, it's taking place at the old ECW Arena, now called the 2300 Arena. I'm going to be there. I know Jamie Ward's going to be there. Ron Lemieux is coming in. My son Zach will be making an appearance after about a year. So it's pretty exciting. Jeff, who else will be there? Do we know anybody else?
I believe our friend Eric Chulminski will be there. And
Eric Chulminski.
There's one other guy. Who is it? I'm trying to remember now. Oh, yeah. Me. Jeff Bowdrin. They call me the Booker. I will be in Philadelphia. Boom! Surprise, Lemieux. First time I've seen Lemieux in stinking 20 stinking years, Barry. So, folks, I am anxiously awaiting my trip to Philadelphia, and Barry's anxiously awaiting going to Philadelphia to the airport to picking me up.
We're going to
try to have a little Breaking Kayfabe get together before the card. I'm going to have Mr. Rose, because he knows the area. I'm going to have him pick out a spot, because I'm sure it'll be food related. And we'd love to have a little meet and greet with all our listeners in the greater Philadelphia area and the Pennsylvania area. As Barry has told me, we have a number of listeners that are from around there. So, folks, we really hope you come out. Rumors of Brian Last showing up to Philadelphia have been denied vociferously. So there will be no TGBL in Philadelphia. So
yes, this is going to be exciting. And partly it's, first off, Jeff, I am going to take you to the world's greatest donut shop, which is Curiosity Donuts, which is where my son is currently employed.
Does that mean we get him perked?
No, we just the opposite. I don't get a discount there.
Oh, I'm treated. What up?
Yeah, exactly.
Come on, Zach.
But I'm going to try to get our, I'm going to try to get our boy Chris Spiker, Chris, who manages a donut shop also in this area. And I've been trying to get him over there to try these donuts. So maybe we can get him over there. But we do. We've got a bunch of listeners really within an hour driving distance of where we are. So if we can get people that, look, even if you can't make the show, but you want to come and just hang out maybe in the afternoon, maybe we'll pick out a lunch spot, something like that. This is bound to be a lot of fun. You know, we're going to cause trouble somewhere. So hopefully everybody can join us.
Think of the opportunity to have your photo taken with Bowdred and Barry. Does it get much better than that? Really? I mean, come on, people. Anyway, Barry, next we will be discussing something that recently came up on, I think, on the message board. Barry, we were having a discussion about the movie Best in Show and also the movie Spinal Tap. Best in Show or Spinal Tap, which one you got?
Oh, my God. Was this a post in the group?
I don't know where I saw it, but I was just like, wow, okay. That's a great topic for the show.
That is a great. So Christopher Guest has made some fantastic movies. Best in Show is, I could watch that movie, and I have watched it probably 10 to 15 times, and I still laugh. There are scenes in that movie. Spinal Tap, though, was revolutionary, and I believe that was his first movie. Spinal Tap was revolutionary when it came out in 1984, and I will always choose Spinal Tap. I absolutely love that movie, and I still laugh. There are several scenes in a couple – when it keeps getting – I mean, the drummer keeps dying, which I think is great. They go through drummers because their drummers keep exploding and dying, but the herpes on the mouth, which I think is great – but there's so much about this movie that I just think is funny. And it was just, you know, watching these guys, Harry Shearer, who's, you know, just created The Simpsons. You know, he's got all these characters on The Simpsons. And Michael McKean, who, you know, we were just talking about Michael McKean in Better Call Saul. This was a guy that started off as Lenny. I knew him as Lenny. And then he became, you know, was he Nigel? I'm trying to think of Spinal Tap, what character he played. I think Nigel might have been Christopher Guest. But in any case, Michael McKean, and then, you know, and then he goes on to Better Call Saul, and he's done so much. So Spinal Tap, what a movie. Just what a fantastic movie.
I am going to throw a curve here and say, while I love Spinal Tap, and I was just going to say my favorite scene in that movie is when the band gets lost backstage, going out to the stage, and they, all right, here we go. And they keep making a wrong turn and keep getting lost backstage. That's just absolutely side splitting. But I love Best in Show. That's one of my favorite movies that are like under the radar that you don't hear about. Like, you know, we talk about great comedy movies and Stripes and Rodney Dangerfield and the Saturday Night Live stuff. But holy crap, Best in Show. If you have a dog, you don't even have to like going to dog shows. If you have a dog and you watch that movie, there is something that happens in that movie that will make you piss your pants, because there are so many funny scenes, so many great characters in that movie. And Fred Willard as the TV announcer for the
he's great
for the AKC event is he's just a riot and so, so funny, Barry. So now next we are going to I want to mention that there was a discussion also on our group. Thank you to Richard Newsham. Richard's in the UK, Barry. And Kevin Dignam, who's from Massachusetts, we were talking a little James Bond. And I told Richard that we had previously had a discussion on who our favorite Bonds were. But I wanted to just tell them I always love talking about James Bond. It's a subject near and dear to my heart. Richard said Roger Moore is his favorite. That's the one he grew up on. So I told him I had to basically put him in his place, Barry, and tell him that there's Sean Connery, nobody else. But Richard admitted he grew up watching Roger Moore, so I can respect that. But I appreciate the guys joining in the discussion. I also want to give a special shout-out to David DeVries. David is from South Australia. I'm going to take 25 seconds here, Barry, and just tell David that this is for you.
Much to say, but man, I still think them cats are crazy.
Do you know why I mentioned David? Because David said, by God, there hasn't been enough discussion of Thin Lizzy on the group. So, David, boom, there's a little Thin Lizzy for you. Now, before we go into our final discussion, which is on John Hughes and his legacy, I want to just give a shout out to MD Tyler, because MD, we promised you that we were going to do our top five movie quotes. And quite frankly, yesterday, Mr. Rose texted me and said, hey, can we put that off a week? So what we're going to do is we're going to put off the movie quote segment in our top five till next episode. But as a special treat for MD and all those people that are looking for movie quotes, we are turning this into a two-parter, Barry. We are going to do our favorite movie quotes. And the week after that, we're going to do our top five funny movie quotes. So, MD, since we're making you wait a week, we're going to throw you a little bone and turn it into a two-parter, Barry. You think you can handle that?
I think I can, and I hope the world is ready to hear 80,000 Big Lebowski quotes, because I'm ready to deliver on that.
I would be shocked if you did that, Barry. That's so unlike you. So, yeah. Now, Barry, we want to talk, and quite frankly, I'm going to sort of throw the mic over to my friend, Mr. Rose, because Barry was the one that suggested that we discuss the legacy of John Hughes, writer, director of so many great movies in the 80s. And Barry, since we just recently remember him having passed away on August 6th of 2009, and we wanted to talk a little bit about the legacy of John Hughes. So why don't you take it, Barry?
Yeah, absolutely, too. And, you know, so when I saw that it was the anniversary, which I can't believe it's been so many years since he died, it was, you know, I started going through and I started saying, okay, who are my favorite movie directors? And for me, it's, you know, Quentin Tarantino's right there. I like John Carpenter a lot. And John Hughes is right there. And then I was really surprised when I did some research that John Hughes only directed 8 films. And for some reason, I thought he had done something like 20 or 25. Now, certainly he was a writer and producer on a lot of films. You know, if I look, he did, he directed 8. He, as a producer, he's got 23 credits. And as a writer, he's got 51 credits. So it's a big difference. And certainly on some of the movies, you know, he did all 3. But, you know, a movie that I know that you like a lot, which I also like, you know, but I know that it's definitely one of your favorites, Some Kind of Wonderful. You know, he wrote that movie, and I believe he produced it as well, but he didn't direct it. For some reason, I always thought of it as quote-unquote a John Hughes film because he did all 3, and he didn't. So I was really surprised about that. But, you know, he had such a great legacy. You know, if you go back to the facts and you look at some of the credits, some of his writing credits, too, you know, he did Mr. Mom. He did National Lampoon's Vacation, which, you know, that's incredible to me. You know, he did Weird Science, Pretty in Pink, The Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He wrote The Great Outdoors. You know, he wrote National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. He wrote Home Alone, you know, which really I think a lot of people think that he actually directed that when he did, and that was Christopher Columbus. But you look at his legacy as a director, and I guess that's what we're primarily going to focus on. And he's got 8 films, and I would say out of that 8, 5 are very good, 1 is good, and the other 2 I'm definitely like, yeah, whatever. So starting off, 1984 was his first film as a director. He was also a writer at 16 Candles. And I love the movie 16 Candles, Jeff. I got to tell you, when I first moved to New York, and I think I've told this story probably 1 or 80,000 times on the podcast, but I moved to New York. I dropped out of young kids listening to this, take this advice. If you get a great piece of ass, throw everything out and just move wherever she is. So I dropped out of college, and I moved to New York to date this girl. We broke up like 3 weeks later, and I stayed in New York for a year because I was having the greatest time. But the first movie I ever saw in New York that she took me out to see was 16 Candles, and it was very sweet. We sat there, we laughed, we had dinner, we held hands, whatever. This movie will always have a special place in my heart. His next film that he directed was probably the one that I think kind of just solidified his career, and that was The Breakfast Club. And The Breakfast Club, what I always thought was cool about The Breakfast Club, and I think I was 21 when this movie came out, so I wasn't a 16 or 17-year-old kid, but when you watch the characters on the screen, I think we can all relate to at least one of the characters. if not all of those characters. And I remember as I was watching this movie, and I had a conversation with a friend afterwards, a young lady, and she said, she goes, you know, when I saw this movie, I saw you up on screen. And I was like, oh, who was I? And she said, well, you were this character. And in my head, I'm thinking she's going to say I was this other character. So I always thought that was cool with The Breakfast Club. His next movie, which he also did later in 85, was Weird Science. And he was also a writer on that. Now, Jeff, I know you recently saw Weird Science, and I don't believe that you were a huge fan of it, if I recall.
Well, you know, let me tell you something. As I was looking through some of John's legacy here, I have a very controversial opinion here. And the reason I have this opinion and I remember this is because I want to say about 2 years ago, I had a chance to mention that after – geez, was it 30, 40 years? Has it been 40 years, 1985? Let me see. No, I'm sorry, 30 years. I finally got around to watching The Breakfast Club, and I'd never seen The Breakfast Club before. And I watched it, and quite frankly, I went, yeah, I don't know what the big deal is here. This, to me, I just thought like some of the characters were really kind of annoying and didn't really resonate with me. I don't know if it's because I wasn't looking at it through the eyes of a 24-year-old. Maybe I would have enjoyed the movie more when I was younger. But, you know, now being 50-plus years old, I just – it didn't hit me the way that his previous film, which was – oh, God. What,
16 Candles?
16 Candles. Thank you. I just drew a complete blank.
Yeah.
16 Candles is one of my favorite movies of all time. I love that movie. I love the Donger. I love, you know, Farmer Ted. All those characters, and it was such a great movie about high school. And I'm absolutely positive it's because when I first saw 16 Candles, I was probably in my early to mid 20s. So it resonated with me much more than The Breakfast Club did. And so The Breakfast Club to me was a huge disappointment when I finally got around to seeing it. Now, he had other movies that Weird Science, again, was another one that I saw with the benefit of being 50 plus than seeing in the years. I mean, I thought it was a cute movie. I always thought I liked Anthony Michael Hall. I thought he was a good actor, but it didn't resonate with me like 16 Candles did. Now, if I'm going to go through and list movies that he did that I liked, Ferris Bueller, I liked. I know there are some people that think that Ferris Bueller's the absolute funniest movie of all time and should be up there on a pedestal. I think it's a good movie. I don't think it's like fantastic. What do you think about Ferris Bueller?
I like it. Look, I like it a lot, actually. Is it the top tier? I don't know. That's Dan Quayle's favorite movie. Do you remember that whole deal?
Yes,
from like 25. That would have been a really, really big deal that this was the vice president's favorite. Whatever happened to Dan Quayle, by the way? How did he just disappear into complete oblivion? I like Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It's not my favorite. I ranked all my favorites. You know, it's not my number one. But there's something very endearing about Ferris. Hey, Mia Sara, first off, was phenomenal. What a beautiful, beautiful girl she was, or woman. And I like, I guess, the first half of the movie. The second half takes it in a different direction, maybe the last third of the movie. But some people, you're right, some people absolutely lose their minds over it. And I watched it again recently. I will say this, too. In looking at the list of John Hughes movies, I think I saw all of them when they came out. So again, I had the luxury of seeing The Breakfast Club in theaters in 1985 when I was 21 years old. It doesn't translate as well now. Like I think I watched it with one of my kids a year ago when it was on cable, and it doesn't really translate as well, and you're right when you say that the kids are essentially annoying, because each one is annoying in a different way. I still like the movie, but yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from. Weird Science was kind of fluff, and Weird Science was, I saw Weird Science opening day in Los Angeles. I remember it clearly. I thought it was great. It's not something that stays with you a month later, but when you watch it, you go, this is a lot of fun. You know, this is good. I like this. Ferris Bueller, we talked about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles in 1987. This is an underrated movie.
Yes, and that was a very good.
People will talk. yeah, people will talk about it, but it doesn't get the same kind of love that, say, Ferris Bueller's Day Off or The Breakfast Club or even 16 Candles get. And it's really, really good. Steve Martin and John Candy, I love John Candy. That's no secret. They had a really, really amazing chemistry here. And this movie just plays out. I absolutely think this is probably my second favorite John Hughes movie ever. And then there's a little bit of a drop off. In 1988, he puts out She's Having a Baby, where he was writer, producer, and director. Have you ever seen this movie, She's Having a Baby?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think about this?
Well, of course, the best part of She's Having a Baby is Elizabeth McGovern, because I love Elizabeth McGovern. But I tell you what I liked about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. You know, and I'm sitting here as we're talking, I'm looking over the IMDb site, and you know, I was thinking about the fact that John Candy with John Hughes made Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and Uncle Buck. And essentially in Uncle Buck, you know, John Candy's playing the guy that you knew from SCTV and from, you know, Stripes, that kind of big, larger-than-life character. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, he's acting in that. And he really is good because he's playing a very sort of sad, pathetic guy you know, I really think he really stretched himself in that role, and I give him a lot of credit for that. And then he went back, and Uncle Buck was maybe a little bit more popular than Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, but I'm not sure if when you talk about a movie that's a good movie, I think Planes, Trains, and Automobiles might be a better movie. Uncle Buck might be funnier, but I think if you're going to watch a movie that doesn't get dated, I think Planes, Trains, and Automobiles does not get as dated as Uncle Buck might.
Yeah, too, and that's Uncle Buck is where we first discovered Macaulay Culkin, who really was just kind of a scene stealer, and really this was the impetus for Macaulay Culkin going into Home Alone, which, you know, again, he was a writer on and may have produced. I'd have to check the credits, but I think he did produce and wrote it. So I like Uncle Buck. It's Uncle Buck to me seems like a one note kind of thing. Like, I don't know. There's not enough there. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is very deep. There's a lot of layers. It's very funny. There are certain scenes that I think are hysterical. You know, the soft pillows, I think, is great. I even think about the soft pillows and I start to laugh.
Is that your hand?
But yeah, exactly. But it's, there's a sweetness to it. And, you know, and again, it's, you're right about John Candy acting. He's not doing, you know, one of his characters from Second City Television like he does in a lot of his movies. He is acting here. She's Having a Baby, though. I just, Elizabeth McGovern, Kevin Bacon, and, it was kind of flat to me. And I think, you know, knowing that it was a John Hughes movie, I think I rushed to the theater and I was like, oh yeah, that's it. Okay. You know, and even now I think I've watched it one time since 88. So literally in the last 30 years, I may have seen it once, and I really can't tell you too much more other than what the basic story is. I don't really remember any of the scenes or anything like that. And we talked about Uncle Buck, very good movie, but 91 was the last movie that he directed, which was Curly Sue. And, I didn't do enough research, I'm going to assume, because I don't know why he would have stopped directing movies in 91, unless it was a really horrible experience with Curly Sue, which it may have been, because if you've ever seen the movie, it's just not a good movie.
Yeah, you know, one of the things is, as you look on the IMDb page, that he obviously started becoming more active in the role of as a producer. He was a producer for such movies as National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation with Chevy Chase, the before mentioned Home Alone. Two movies that he was a producer of that are really underrated movies that I really enjoyed was Career Opportunities, which was, I believe, the debut of Jennifer Connelly. No, I shouldn't say that. She was in Once Upon a Time in America. But this was her debut as sort of almost like a sex symbol. And I believe the actor that she acted with was Frank Whaley. Did you ever see this one, Barry?
Oh, yeah. So I saw this one in the movie theater in South Miami. And I was supposed to be working that day. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go see a movie. And I saw the movie. And holy cow, because I left that theater with the biggest crush on anybody I've ever had. Jennifer Connelly steals this movie. If you've never seen Career Opportunities, rush out, rent it, see if it's on Netflix. I guess you can't rush out and rent it, but see if it's on Netflix or possibly on cable. But it, the whole movie is literally Frank Whaley, Jennifer Connelly, and they're in a department store overnight. So it essentially is two actors carrying the entire movie. It's a very good movie, and she is absolutely incredible. He's a really good actor, too.
Yeah, Frank he was actually in...
He was in one of my favorite movies, Jeff, that we've never brought up with Matthew Broderick called The Freshman.
Well, that's good, but it's not the one I was talking about.
And he was also a regular on Ray Donovan. He spent a lot of time. But which movie were you talking about?
Barry, of course. He was in Pulp Fiction.
He was in Pulp Fiction. That's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, briefly.
He had a sudden exit, let's just say. But no, that's a very good movie. Another movie that John Hughes was the producer of that's very underrated, that again stars John Candy, is Only the Lonely, which I believe may have been Maureen O'Hara's last movie. And he plays a Chicago cop who is sort of doted upon by his mother. And he's trying to start a romance, but his mom kind of keeps interfering in it. But it's a really much more low key, kind of sweet romantic comedy set in Chicago. But have you ever seen Only the Lonely?
Yeah, I didn't connect with it. I didn't, for whatever reason. I just, something about it. That's the one. Is it Maureen O'Hara?
Yes, Maureen O'Hara and Ali Sheedy, who was in the Breakfast Club.
Right, so he's working again with Ali Sheedy. But you start going through his resume too, and you just look, and you realize he wrote The First Vacation, which to me is, that's unbelievable. But as a producer or a writer, some kind of wonderful. And Jeff, you've talked about your crush with Mary Stuart Masterson,
sure,
numerous times. Absolutely, too. The Great Outdoors. And we've discussed The Great Outdoors. I think when I was bringing up Summer Rental, you confused it with The Great Outdoors, which really, but in all fairness, it's a very similar movie with just a different setting, starring John Candy. So I could see how it would happen. And I like Summer Rental better, but he was the executive producer on The Great Outdoors, Christmas Vacation, Career Opportunities, Dutch with Ed O'Neill. And then he kind of right around that same time of Curly Sue is where, and that was again the last movie that he directed, but he started producing movies like Flubber and 101 Dalmatians and Baby's Day Out, Dennis the Menace, Home Alone 3. So the quality, for whatever reason, had slipped, and I don't know what it was. And he was, there was a documentary, and we've never discussed this, and I've never seen the full documentary, but it was something like Searching for John Hughes, and he was really reclusive, and he never wanted to do interviews. He wasn't an outgoing guy, super reclusive, and these two guys, I don't know, mid-20s, I guess, decided to do this documentary where they would go searching for him and just basically say, you were such a huge part of our childhood when we were growing up. And I believe he died during the filming of that or right after. Somehow it's all connected to it. But did you know that he had a falling out with Molly Ringwald and Anthony Michael Hall?
I did not know that.
Neither did I. So I, again, in doing a little bit of research on his death, and I think we just passed his death like a day or two ago, which, the anniversary of his death. But apparently he cut off contact with them, after they rejected some of his scripts in the mid 1980s. When he died in 2009, he hadn't spoken to them in over 20 years. And wow. Molly Ringwald. Yeah, exactly. Which is really sad, but apparently Molly Ringwald, wrote an editorial about his death, and she said, "Most people who knew John knew that he was able to hold a grudge longer than anyone. His grudges were almost supernatural things, enduring for years, even decades." And Anthony Michael Hall said that he suspected he was never forgiven for turning down parts in Pretty in Pink and Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And then I guess he also turned down Some Kind of Wonderful. And Anthony Michael Hall said, he goes, "Not because I didn't want to work with John anymore. I loved working with him more than anyone before or since. I think he was trying to get out of the typecast roles." So that was just kind of sad. And then you read about his death, and he was just a guy, you know, he was visiting family in New York, walking down West 55th Street, and just had a heart attack, taking a morning stroll, and just died. So, you know, to me, just a real iconic filmmaker for the time, and a guy that I think captured, if you were in your teen years or your early 20s in the mid-80s, you were seeing John Hughes films. You know, there was no way about it. You were definitely seeing his films. And like I say, to me, 16 Candles, you love it, I love it. It's my favorite John Hughes film ever. Whether it's Long Duck Dong, you know, Sexy American Girlfriend, the whole movie's great. And it's taken some criticism over the years. And no doubt you're aware of this criticism, right, Jeff?
I'm guessing because of the stereotype or what?
So, yeah.
The minor stereotype of the Long Duck Dong character.
That and the sexual assault of the girl who's passed out.
Oh, yeah.
So there are a few things. And this year, Molly Ringwald actually wrote an essay about Hughes's films. And it's inspired by the Me Too movement. And she noted that some elements of the films were painful to watch because of the way women, including characters played by Molly herself, were mistreated in them, and that it was important to balance Hughes' brilliance with the way his films have been morally flawed. And this is, you know, this is a conversation, if you remember, you, myself, and Brian last had a conversation about Revenge of the Nerds. Maybe a month or two ago. And you know, when I saw Revenge of the Nerds, I saw nothing wrong with it. And when certain things are pointed out, such as, you know, the one character played by Robert Carradine tricks a girl into thinking that he's her boyfriend and has sex with her, that's essentially rape. And, you know, so there are,
it's not really things. Essentially, and in fact is,
I guess it could be considered rape. And there's the filming of the girls in the, in their bathroom and all throughout their dormitory. So there's several felonies that are being committed throughout this movie. And certainly in 16 Candles, there are certain scenes which could be, but I don't remember watching in 1984 thinking this was an issue. Certainly in hindsight, yes, it's an issue. I absolutely see it. But I think Molly Ringwald, she was very fair in this essay that she wrote, where, you know, like, you know, again, when this was happening, this was a different world at that time. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we'll look back on and say, okay, this is wrong. There are certain things occurring right at this moment that I think we'll look back on in 30, 40, and 50 years and go, wow, that was really, really terrible. Regardless, I still love the movie 16 Candles. And I think a lot of the characters, yes, Long Duck Dong is culturally, I guess, a stereotype. But at the same time, he's a very endearing character, and I like him a lot.
And, you know, I'm sitting here and I realize that one movie that we haven't discussed that was a very popular John Hughes movie was Pretty in Pink with Molly Ringwald, and it had James Spader, Andrew McCarthy, John Cryer. Your boy Harry Dean Stanton played her dad. And That was a movie I can remember seeing at the theater. And that was I remember there was such a huge controversy over whether or not she ended up at the end of the movie with the wrong guy. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. So was she going to end up with Andrew McCarthy, or is she going to end up with Ducky?
Yep. And Andrew McCarthy's name was Blaine, which as
Blaine. That was another thing that John Hughes was a genius with. Do you remember the heel's name in Some Kind of Wonderful?
Oh, God, no. I know. I can see the actor's face that played the heel.
Craig Schaefer, I think.
That's right.
The
boyfriend. You played the boyfriend. Yeah.
He's really just really an asshole. Like, this is a guy I remember, and I saw this movie a couple of months also. This was on cable, and I remember thinking, my God, I wanted to jump through the screen and punch this guy right in the face. Just a horrible, horrible douchebag. His character's name was Hardy. So
yes,
John Hughes had this thing of Blaine and Hardy, taking these kind of waspy and, you know, Anglo names and giving them to him. I like Some Kind of Wonderful. Leah Thompson did a very good job. And that was actually, if I'm correct, was directed by the guy who had become her husband, who is Howard Deutsch. I believe they met on Howard the Duck. Have you ever seen Howard the Duck?
No, I managed to miss that, even though I love Leah Thompson. You're
smart. Very, very, very smart. So they met on the set of Howard the Duck and they got married. And I believe he directed her in this film as well. And I love Leah Thompson, too. I must have seen all the right moves for her nude scene probably 100 times.
I guess Leah, based on that comment, Barry, can say hashtag me too, because you're just obviously exploiting her. So I tell you what I love about Pretty in Pink, just real quick, that I remembered and I went and looked it up, is I love the line by John Cryer when Molly Ringwald is referring to Blaine and he says, his name is Blaine? That's not a name, it's a major appliance, which I thought was a great line.
I will say too, there is a show, it's called Roast Battles. And it's
I did watch that.
So do you know that? So there was actually a wrestling connection. Dolph Ziggler was on.
Yes, I saw his Roast episode. Battle.
Yeah. Well, guess what? Molly Ringwald and John Cryer go head to head on Roast Battles. So, wow. So absolutely, that's one you. I haven't seen it yet, but you definitely want to check that out to see that. And
that's the TV show.
Pretty good.
I was going to say that's a TV show on Comedy Central with Jeffrey Ross.
Great Jeffrey Ross. Absolutely.
Does the roast all the time. Yeah, I'm sorry. I interrupted you. Go ahead, Barry.
No, you're good. You're good. It's he had a really good career. He was on that 2.5 Men for several years and actually had a really nice career. And Molly kind of fell off the wayside for whatever reason. There was a lot of rumors or talk, you know, that she was very, very difficult to work with. And possibly that explains why. But you go back and you look at the career, and let's say Breakfast Club is the iconic movie for John Hughes. Some people would say Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and certainly Matthew Broderick had a very good career. But when you look at the five main actors of the Breakfast Club, you know, nobody really had this breakout career. You know, Anthony Michael Hall, TV's Firestarter, which aired on the USA Network in a few movies. Ally Sheedy, who literally made a few movies. She was off Broadway in a show called Hedwig and the Angry Inch about 20 years ago that I happened to see her in a couple of times. But she you know, her face is on a milk carton at this point. Judd Nelson made a couple of movies and then was on Suddenly Susan. Emilio Estevez, Emilio Estevez, one of my favorite actors and my favorite movie of all time, Repo Man. But, you know, he's basically behind the camera now doing small movies.
Yeah, I'm going to have to say of the group, I think Emilio Estevez was the one that had the best career, really, at least the longest career.
Yeah, I think he did, too. He's not doing a whole lot of acting, but I know he's producing and directing movies and did something a year and a half or 2 years ago. Did something on the Kennedys a few years back that it was critically received. So he's done pretty well.
I have to mention, or my wife will kill me, that he was also, of course, Barry, in the Mighty Ducks series, which my wife loves. Which is not one of the
The Mighty Ducks series, which we had some news this week on one of the
That was amazing. Yeah. Apparently he has fallen into the depths of drug addiction and is not a good look on him.
So. No, if for anybody out there, look, there's no this whole don't do drugs, it's bad shit doesn't work. But for God's sake, look at this guy from 20 years ago and look at him now at 38 years old. Holy shit. Like, that's what fucking drugs will do to you. I mean, he just really, and I feel horrible for the guy because to me, I can't believe it's the same guy and I can't believe he's only 38 years old. So it's really sad, but a very, very good movie, The Mighty Ducks. And that franchise did well. Was there 4 installments of The Mighty Ducks?
I know there were 3. I don't know if they made a 4th or not. Maybe been a direct-to-video kind of thing. So anyway, Barry, you about ready to wrap it up here, my friend?
Well, Jeff, before we do – I have a lot on my agenda. We haven't recorded in 3 weeks. I absolutely do. So your favorite John Hughes movie of all time is 16 Candles?
Correct.
We agree. We agree, Jeff Bowdrin, and this is a big day. I actually have 3 things I want to hit. It's 2 things. So our buddy Aaron Grafton, who I believe recently moved from Arkansas to the Midwest. I think he's in the Chicago area right now. And Aaron will also be attending CWF Legends Fan Fest 4 with our buddy John Doe, Travis Raines, coming up November the 3rd in the Tampa suburb of Lutz at the Residence Inn by Marriott Tampa Suncoast Parkway at North Point Village, which is the longest hotel name in the history of hotel names. So far, Pat Patterson, who never does fan fests, will be joined by Jerry Briscoe, Ron Fuller, Robert Fuller, and coming up in a couple of weeks, Jeff, we are going to announce the rest of the lineup. We got some other big names coming up. So I know Aaron Grafton will be there. We encourage all of our listeners, if you're within driving distance of Tampa, if you're not within driving distance, and to me, driving distance, Jeff, is 1,000 miles, you should be at this fan fest. So you can get tickets if you go to CWF Legends Fan Fest group on Facebook, or you can also join the Championship Wrestling from Florida Archives Facebook group. And Jeff, did you happen to notice the post we had yesterday and Don Morocco showed up? And Don comes in and out maybe once a month, maybe once every couple of weeks, but he posted three or four comments that were really deep, and these were several hundred words, so this wasn't like a yes or a no. He was giving real in-depth color, and what we were discussing, I had posted a letter from the Los Angeles wrestling promoter, Mike LaBelle, that a letter sent to Eddie Graham, and it was really complaining about two things. One was that somebody in Los Angeles or somebody in Miami was airing Los Angeles television without the authorization of the LA office, and he was pissed off about that. And then he was pissed that Vern Gagne was defending the AWA title in Hawaii. So Don Morocco got on, Don Morocco being a native Hawaiian, which was a shoot, got on and basically was clarifying that anybody could work Hawaii, that the AWA guys worked there, the WWF guys, the NWA guys, but was really good, and then started to talk about Mark Lewin and King Curtis working there and working in Australia, and it was just really interesting stuff that I had never heard before. And it was funny because when I said this to you, we both had the same thought. This would be a really, really good guest for Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. So as a heads up, I did reach out to Don Morocco. I haven't heard anything, but if Don Morocco wants to do our show, you can be rest assured he'll be on this show. So after just giving that really, really long promo about Aaron Grafton and his what-ifs, he sent me two what-ifs, and one was a real legitimate question that I thought about. And I can actually tie it into the fan fest, which Aaron told me I could do, but he said, everything else equal, Jack Briscoe never wrestled professionally. Does Jerry still accomplish everything he has? So I really gave that a lot of thought, Jeff. Now, do you want to answer that one? And I can piggyback. You want me to answer and you can piggyback?
No, you answer and I'll piggyback.
Jerry does accomplish everything that he set out to do. And, you know, if we're judging it by accomplishments, maybe Jack was the more successful. He was NWA World's Heavyweight Champion when a world title in professional wrestling meant something. That being said, Jerry had a hell of a career. Jerry did, and Jerry didn't get a career because he was Jack's brother. You know, there was a lot of areas that he went that he worked on his own. And Jerry behind the scenes was a powerhouse. You know, we just talked about Patterson and Briscoe. The WWE in its formation years, you know, which was WWF, was really three guys at that time. It was Vince McMahon, it was Jerry Briscoe, and it was Patterson. So behind the scenes, Jerry was a massive, massive power player. Were doors open because his last name was Briscoe? I'm going to have to say they probably were. On that note, I think Jerry accomplished a shitload of stuff out of the state of Florida that made him, in my opinion, a legend. You know, Jerry Briscoe to me is a legend regardless of who his brother was.
The only thing that I will quantify your comments with, and I think they're completely valid, is that I wonder if there is no Jack Briscoe, does Jerry take that step into pro wrestling? Because, you know, when I sat down and had dinner with Jerry, he talked about the fact that his original start in the business was he went to see his brother wrestle one night. He was in college, I believe, and somebody had no-showed, and he was sitting there talking to Jack. And I want to say it was Buddy Colt. This was in the Oklahoma territory. Buddy Colt was wrestling as Ron Reed. And he said, well, hey, why don't we get that guy to do it? And Jerry basically stepped in and just kind of learned on the job. And so I really wonder if Jack had never been there, would Jerry have sought out pro wrestling as a career? But other than that, what you said was completely valid.
Yeah, I just, you know, there's always the – if you're a younger brother or if you're the son of a wrestler or promoter, there's always going to be that, you know, and that's every time the Mike Graham thing comes up, I always get very defensive with that. Mike Graham was no Eric Watts, and I don't mean to knock Eric Watts. He was no Angelo Mosca Jr. Mike Graham was a very, very solid, capable worker that, if anything, Eddie Graham held down a little bit. He held him back. Mike Graham wrestled for 10 years before he finally got the Florida heavyweight title. He was primarily known as a junior heavyweight or a tag team wrestler. So he wasn't getting these main event pushes. Occasionally he would get a main event push, but you didn't see Mike Graham in the main events. You saw Dusty Rhodes. You saw Jack Briscoe. You saw Sweet Brown Sugar. You saw Bugsy McGraw. Mike Graham was semi-main event or mid-card. He had his fans. He was a solid wrestler, but nepotism. And whenever I hear that, it immediately tells me that somebody has no idea what the fuck they're talking about. There was no nepotism when it came to Mike at all, because he was not pushed to the top. A guy like Eric Watts, who was pushed to the top. So the second what if, and we have to thank our friends who come forth with these what if questions, because I love these, Jeff. Did Top Heels have the same vehicle maintenance agreement with promoters that Dalton had with the Double Deuce and Roadhouse?
Wow, that's an extremely fair question that I absolutely don't know the answer to.
I don't believe that they did. I think if
they should have. You know,
they should have, but, you know, you got to remember there was no health insurance. I'm sure they didn't have anything. And there's all these stories out there about guys and their cars and rocks being thrown and tires slashed, and guys realized they had to park their cars away from the arena and walk or do something else. So, yeah, they didn't. Dalton had a good arrangement, though, but, you know, Patrick Swayze, of course he did.
Yeah, you know, he's Patrick Swayze. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all right, I'm going to give a little preview, Barry, if it's okay to start wrapping it up, of next week's episode. Barry, I had a chance, and I discussed this with you, to do a little search on the YouTube for something. And lo and behold, I ran across a litany of matches from an area that we've never really given its credit and we've never really discussed. And I am talking about Houston Wrestling with Paul Bosch. So next week, we're going to take a look at a couple, if not maybe two, even three, if you're really good, matches from the heyday of Houston wrestling in the late 70s and early 80s. That is an area, Barry, that I think that we have been shamefully underrating and have not included. I know we mentioned the DiBiase Duggan match that would happen in Houston, but wow, Houston has such a great wrestling history and a great wrestling legacy, and I think it's about time we took a look at it.
Yeah, when you told me this too, I was really excited. So I think we have we probably have the next two episodes kind of laid out between Houston and the movie quote. So this should be a lot of fun. And of course, we'll always be throwing in a few surprises as well.
Absolutely. I encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. My book, Breaking Kayfabe, Dinner with the Wrestling Legends, is still available at Crowbar Press. My friend Scott Teal. Barry, I'm just going to throw this out there. You know, I submitted the work for the next book. They call me the Booker, the Scott. My stories, my writings for Dave Meltzer and the Wrestling Observer in the early 90s. And lo and behold, Scott goes to the Waterloo Hall of Fame ceremonies and runs into my old friend Bruce Mitchell. And lo and behold, my friend Bruce offered a suggestion to Scott about my book. And Bruce, I really want to say thank you for that, buddy. I appreciate it. Because now there may be a slight delay and the new Bowdrin book coming out. So thank you for that, Bruce. Oh, son of a bitch, I'm going to get you for that. So until next week, for my good friend Barry Rose, we will talk to you later, folks.